Okay, I didn't really know what the other talks in this series were. I live down in London, and actually I wish I'd come up to listen to this, I'm really interested. And in fact, I suppose given that sequence, one might rather expect this one to be on Buddhism and psychology. You know, it's on Buddhism and the mind. But really I'm going to be mainly talking about Buddhist attitudes to awareness, human consciousness and the mind, in its own term. So I'm not going to be doing comparisons with Western ideas about the mind, although there is something of that in the book. And in fact, I wanted to try and keep this fairly sort of experiential. And so I wanted to start with a story from the Buddhist tradition, which I don't know if it's true or not, but it's purported to come from the time of the Buddha, and it features sort of a very common character in stories about the Buddha's own teaching and his own life. And this was Ananda. And Ananda was, in a way, the closest disciple of the Buddha in his later years. And in fact, he was the Buddha's cousin. He was the Buddha's youngest cousin. Occasionally, he's presented as somebody the same age as the Buddha, but this seems extremely unlikely, judging by the kind of relationship there was between them and what he was like. His naivety, in fact, he's a naive, delightful, but naive character, Ananda. So he does sometimes get things rather wrong. He's fairly young at this stage, and he decided to become a celibate Buddhist monk, a follower of the Buddha, but a full-time follower, somebody who had renounced family life and so on. And he decided to become a follower, a full-time follower of the Buddha, simply because he was so personally impressed by the Buddha himself. Now, Ananda, one day, once upon a time, Ananda met a woman called Matangi, a young woman who was drawing water from a well. And it was a hot day, he was very thirsty, so he went up to her and said, "Have you got any to spare in the bucket? Can I have a drink?" And she was, first of all, surprised at this. And she said, "Yes, but I'm an untouchable. I'm an untouchable. I can't give you water." And of course, in case you're not familiar with this, this is still goes on in India today. There are people who are regarded as untouchable by the caste Hindus. And if you accepted, if you were a caste Hindu and accepted a drink of water, or just even just touched, or even a shadow touched you maybe, from an outcast and untouchable, you would be regarded as polluted. You'd have to go through all sorts of ritual, holy ablutions with the Brahmin priesthood and so on. So this is why when Ananda asked her for a drink of water, she said, "But I'm not touchable." And he said to her, "But I didn't ask you about your family. I wasn't asking you about your caste. I was just asking for a drink." And they had a basic human connection, two human beings talking to each other. She lets him have a drink, he had a drink, he said thank you very much, and off they went. Now, it seems that this was the first time that Matangi had ever been treated in this way, that she'd ever been treated in a humane way by anyone outside her immediate family and her immediate clan. And so she was naturally extremely struck by this encounter, and it went over and over in her mind. And of course, Ananda was a young, good-looking man, so that connection just touched her. It touched her in her heart. So the next day, Ananda went, as was normal for monks and still is, he went into the town. The town was called Shravasti, quite a large city, and he went there on his alms round. And what the monks would do on their alms round is they would carry a bowl and they would go to the back door of a house in the morning, and they'd just simply stand there. And with any luck, they were noticed by somebody doing some cooking. And the person doing the cooking, because people would be the women, would do cooking for the men and women working in the fields during the day. So they were doing this in the morning, ready for the package. And so they might have a bit left over. With any luck, there's a bit left over, and they scoop it out and put it in the bowl with the monk. So you weren't supposed to ask for anything. You just say, you stand there for a little while, if nothing happens, you just move on to the next place. And so Arnold was very keen to be fair about this, you know, not just go to the richest houses, hoping for the best food and all that kind of thing. And he ended up in the red light district of Shravasti, in the red light district. And this happens to be where Matangi lived with her mother. And Matangi spotted him coming. Of course, she remembered him. She thought, oh, great. She talked to her mother about him. She'd already been talking in terms of having met this wonderful guy. She wanted to marry him. They were going to settle down. They were going to have a wonderful time. All that. And her mother had been quite, you know, maybe a little bit sort of humouring her, but been quite encouraging with this idea. So anyway, there was Arnold outside the door. And their eyes met. Their eyes met. And before he knew how it happened, Ananda was going in through the door into their house. And then he found himself in her bedroom. And she was whispering in his ear. And then he found himself sitting next to her on the bed. This is, don't worry, this is not going to get too steamy, but... and then, the next moment, they were in each other's arms. They were embracing, they were caressing. And then Arnold suddenly, because you remember Arnold had taken vows, very, very strong vows as a monk of chastity, of not getting involved with sexual behaviour. And he suddenly he remembered the Buddha, he remembered his teacher. And it's as if he had this brilliant vision of the Buddha. And he fled. He leapt up and ran away. And Matangi, quite naturally, went haring after him. So you have to see this scene of, and Arnold decided he'd go back to where he knew the Buddha was. The Buddha was staying in a park outside the town. This is often what the Buddha would do, and this is one of the very common places the Buddha would stay. I think it was called the Jetagrove. And so outside Shravasti, he was staying in the park outside the city gates. Arnold went to hear him from that direction. Matangi was following. After a while, Arnold realised that she was after him. So he thought, he was a nice man. He stopped. He said, okay, let's sit down and talk this over. And he said, look, I just really lost it there. And it's quite important for a monkey to do that. So I'm just going to go and talk to my teacher about it. Do you want to come along? And she said, oh, yeah, yes, I'll come along, yes. So off they went. But what she was saying what she said to him initially was she tried to persuade him. She said, look, you don't have to be a monk. And this is true, actually. If you're a Buddhist monk, it's not that you've signed something away for life. You can disrobe. And it very often happens, in fact. I knew a Tibetan monk here in Cambridge, a really lovely man, and he did, he fell in love, and so he disrobed and got married. You know, and there's no particular stigma with doing that. And in fact, you can do it 7 times. So, in other words, you can always change your mind again if the marriage didn't work out very well or if you did whatever, but you can always go back to your mind again. After 7 times, and I suppose, I don't know who it is who keeps count. After 7 times, they said, look, come on. I think you tried enough time. Let's leave it there. So this is what Matangi said to Arnold. She said, look, let's get married. Come on. Let's get divorced. You know there's a chemistry there, don't you? And Arnold said, look, I just think I'm just going to go and talk to my teacher. I'm going to talk to Buddha. So off they went. Oh, well, Matangi also said, talk to my mum. She's fine. But he was very distraught because he'd lost his mindfulness. And so both of them went off to the Buddha. They arrived in the Jetta Grove, and Arnold went straight to the Buddha, and he told him everything that had happened. Matangi's still there with him. Now, you might expect with these sort of religious stories, you know, he'd get a ticking off. You shouldn't have talked to the Buddha. But the response of the Buddha was a little bit unpredictable. He started engaging in a sort of a Socratic dialogue with Arnold. He started asking Arnold questions about his mind. And when you read this in the sutra, this particular episode is here in its Shirangama Sutra, which is a relatively late work, by the way. It doesn't come from very early Buddhism. But you do find versions of the story from earlier on. Instead of saying you're not aware, you shouldn't have done that, the Buddha actually just starts asking these very inquiring questions. And the first thing he asks Ahmadra, he says, why was it that you decided to leave the household, family life, to leave behind the possibility of marriage and children and so on to become a Buddhist monk? And Ahmadra replied, well, it's because I was so impressed by you, he said, by the Buddha. In other words, there's sort of a charismatic response. You just thought, wow, what a guy, I really want to be part of what this person is setting up. I followed you. And then the Buddha said, what exactly was it that happened? What exactly was it in you that was so impressed? And this is the kind of thing that Ananda, it seems, had never really thought about before. You know, he wasn't a particularly philosophical or psychological sort of guy. But what's with my eyes? My eyes saw you, and then there was something in my mind which came to a conclusion. I recognized your qualities, and I developed this intention that I will try and become one of your followers. Yeah. And then the Buddha really gets down to his questions. Where exactly is that part of you? Where is that mind that made that decision? What is going on? And whatever answer Ananda comes up with, the Buddha shows that it doesn't really make sense. It doesn't really hang together. He shows Ananda that he doesn't really know himself. He doesn't really know his own mind, how it works, what it does, where it is, and so on. So, for example, Ananda says, well, I suppose my mind is inside my body, isn't it, when you ask me where it is? And the Buddha said, well, can you see the inside surface of your skin then, you know, as you look out from this mind that's inside your body? And I was, oh, no, I can't. It must be outside my body then. And then the Buddha said, but if it was outside your body, how could it make your legs and your arms waggle about and so on? You know, surely that doesn't work. And Ananda tried, maybe it's on the sort of the edge, it's sort of on the interface between the inside and the outside. And the Buddha said, no, but it's got all the answers to that one. He said, maybe it's everywhere. And the Buddha answered that one. And then Ananda said, maybe it's nowhere. And so Ananda is quite game for this. He's probably enjoying himself in a way. But he can't find, you know, the Buddha always comes up with an objection and says, but if that was the case, then surely such and such. Always there are problems with his answers. Now, why was it that the Buddha was asking him all these questions? Very hard questions, just after he's nearly broken his vows with this girl. It seems to be because Ananda had lost his mindfulness. He'd lost his continuity of purpose. He'd lost the basic intention that he had in making those vows. Vows, at least in Buddhism, are very, very serious things. So you should be taking them seriously. You should be having the definite intention you're going to keep them, you know, until such a time when you make a formal declaration, no, I'm going to disrobe, I'm not going to do that anymore. He lost his presence of mind. He didn't really know himself. So he had to discover himself. He had to find his mind. And Ananda, as I say, a very interesting character, a very faithful follower of the Buddha, a lover of the Buddha, I suppose you could say. And he faithfully tried to do what he was told. He faithfully tried to do the sit down, do this meditation, study this, discuss this, and do the walking and all that kind of stuff. So he had great confidence in the Buddha and Buddhism. He'd learned all the teachings. In fact, what he was particularly famous for was learning everything by heart. He had a stupendous memory. He certainly wasn't stupid. He'd learnt a huge amount of teaching by heart ever since he'd started as a disciple of the Buddha. But there was something lacking. There was something lacking in his experience. And this reminded me of another story of a great Tibetan teacher, a man called Drol, medieval Tibetan teacher. One day an old gentleman was circumambulating a stupa. A stupa is one of these Buddhist monuments, and one of the meditation and mindfulness practices you can do is you walk clockwise around the stupa, maybe reciting mantras, maybe just being aware of your body. So the old gentleman was doing this practice. He probably had a mala that he was going through as he went around, the mala being a sort of string of beads or rosary beads. And Ron came up to him, the teacher came up to him and said, "Sir, I'm happy to see you circumambulating, but wouldn't you rather be practicing the Dharma?" The Dharma meaning, you know, Buddhist practice. Thinking this over, the old gentleman felt it might be better to read the sutras, in other words, the Buddhist texts. And while he was reading aloud to himself in the temple courtyard, Geshe Drong came up to him again and said, "I'm happy to see you reciting sutras, but wouldn't you be rather be practicing the Dharma?" At this, the old gentleman thought, "I know what it is. Perhaps I should meditate." So he sat cross-legged on a cushion with his eyes half closed. And Teacher Drong came up to him again and said, "I'm very happy to see you meditating, but wouldn't you rather be practicing the Dharma?" Now, utterly confused, the old gentleman asked, "Geshe Ma, please tell me what I should do to practice the Dharma." And the teacher Drong replied, "Renounce attachment to this worldly life, this mundane life. Renounce it now. And once you've renounced this life's habitual thoughts and are no longer distracted by the eight worldly winds, whatever you do will advance you on the path of liberation. Whatever you do will advance you on the path of liberation." So I thought this story also, in a way, applies to Arnold. He missed the point somehow, even though he was doing all the right things. Because Arnold was lacking presence of mind, he was easily distracted by the worldly winds. And these are all the things, like gain and loss and pleasure and pain and neglect and popularity, all these things that tend, sometimes it goes really well, sometimes it doesn't. And we tend to get a bit obsessed by these. You know, am I really good looking at the moment? Am I really feeling that I shouldn't show myself in public? Am I healthy or am I unhealthy? All these worldly winds, they do tend to sort of take up a lot of our energy. And Ananda was like that. So that's why, when he was wandering through the town, he was very easily taken off track, very easily distracted. And without presence of mind, you can easily get into a state. You may find yourself saying regrettable things, breaking your firm resolutions, losing your way, losing your confidence, that kind of thing. And in a way, what is this confidence? Because you say, "Well, actually, Ananda was very confident in the Buddha." But the confidence needs to be in yourself. Ananda was very faithful, he was a follower of the Buddha, but he needed to develop a sense of presence in his own experience, confidence in methodically treading the path that he himself had definitely, consciously, really decided on, and at least had some sense of what it was, what it felt like to be doing it. So this is why the Buddha asked him to look within, to identify who he really was. He asked him to find his own mind. Where is it? And what's it like? And every answer that Ananda gives doesn't work. The Buddha shows that it doesn't hold together. The more you look for the mind, the more you can't find it. But you have to keep looking. It's a bit of a funny paradox. You have to try and open yourself to what it's like to be you, but yet you can never really say. And after a while, you might tend to give up. But the suggestion here is, no, don't give up. Keep on. Keep asking those questions of yourself. At least keep looking. So in this dialogue, the dialogue, by the way, goes on for a good, well, probably half of the sutra. So it's like, I can't really summarise it, but the number of questions that the Buddha comes up with, the number of ways in which he tries to, in a way, bring Ananda around to this sense of the importance of direct experience is quite remarkable. And you can see echoes of this in a lot of later Buddhist tradition, particularly in Zen. So sometimes he just in a Zen-like way, he held up his fist like that, and he asked Ananda to describe what was going on in his experience when the Buddha did that. And Ananda did his best to try and describe it. A bit later, he sort of went up to Ananda and stroked him on the head. And he asked Ananda to describe what's going on there. You know, what was that like? Or sometimes he didn't even ask him, he just did it. Or he pointed to the birds, the trees in the garden outside the sort of lecture room where they were having this discussion. Or he also picked up a length of cloth at one point. I didn't bring one with me, but he picked up a length of cloth and he tied 6 knots in this length of cloth. So if you imagine, well, actually, there's a knot already, but I had to do it just for one knot. And he held up the knot, the 6 knots, and he said to Armida, if I need to undo that knot, do I pull on the right hand end? And I said, no, that's not the right. So I said, do I pull on the left hand end then? He said, no, that's not the right. The answer is, look, you've got to go in the middle. You've actually got to go into the heart of that knot if you want to undo it. And so these 6 knots are the 6 senses of traditional Buddhism. Hearing, smelling, tasting, seeing, touching, and the mind sense, the sense that apprehends ideas and images and memories and so on. So each of those, the Buddha was saying, is knotted. And you've got to get unknotted by finding the centre of that knot. And at one point, the Buddha actually shouted at Armida. And what he said, what he shouted to him was, Armida, hey, this is not your mind. And at this point, Armida simply broke down in tears. And he sat down, and he was angry as well. He was angry with the Buddha, distraught. And he said, if this is not my mind, I haven't got a mind. I must be like the earth or a log. But surely nothing exists beyond what I feel and know. What on earth are you saying? This is not my mind. And the Buddha tries to sort of point out to Ananda that in a way the deep nature of awareness itself, something which is in some sense more essential than the surface activity of his, you know, his knowing, his feeling, his touching, and his senses and all that kind of thing. So I don't think we can really answer questions about our own mind, or at least not with any degree of certainty. But we can't pretend it's not here. And this is very difficult to pretend it's not here. Here it is. Here is our awareness. Here is our life. And that's the most extraordinary thing. So we can at least be present in our experience. We can notice that it's happening. We can't stand outside it and look at it, can we, from the outside? But yet here it is. And in a way, in my opinion, you could almost say it is the most extraordinary thing in the universe, is one's own awareness. One's own awareness, what on earth is going on? What does it mean? Well, maybe you feel you've got it sus, but I don't know. I just think it's very, very strange. It seems to me the fact of being aware is extraordinary. And have you ever wondered, why is it you who is aware? Not somebody else. Why now? Why is it going on now? Not some other time? And so on. Why are you inhabiting this particular body in this particular location? Very good. So I think these questions are quite important. I mean, they're interesting questions in any case. There was a special issue of New Scientist a couple of weeks ago on reality. I thought, well, that's actually interesting. Shouldn't I? I hadn't read all of it yet, but the first little article is trying to define reality, and in the end, really, it comes down to the definition. Well, reality is when you remove all subjectivity completely from your account. So it's an entirely objective account. It doesn't involve personal experience in any way at all, at least as far as you can possibly manage. Then you've got reality. So it seems to me that there's something wrong with that. In a sense, it's a very important way of doing science. It's valuable in that sense. But on the other hand, we do have what we call our subjective experience. We can't really ignore it. I mean, we can't say it's unreal. I think that would be ridiculous. In the same way, it would be ridiculous to say it was the only reality and everything else was just a figment, you know. So it's an extraordinary thing, and well worth sometimes just trying to sort of pay some attention to. And eventually Ananda stops trying to work out what the Buddha is talking about. And he sits down quietly in a corner and he begins to weep. And he admits, he comes out with a sort of confession. He says, what I see now is that I thought that everything would be all right as long as I was with my teacher, as long as I was with my master, that would be enough. I could just sort of almost soak it all in from him. I thought it was enough just to follow him. And he thought that the Buddha would bestow realization on him. He didn't realize that the Buddha couldn't do it for him. That's what he got sight of. He thought that someone else could do it for him. And I think this is often a problem with, as it were, religious people. They rely on something separate to themselves, and they hope that that grace, as it were, that will do it for them. And it does do things in a way, that sort of attitude, but at least what this is saying is it doesn't do enough. It's not enough. So at one point in the Mahabharata, the Buddha says, the Buddhas are only showers of the way. By you must the effort be made. The Buddhas are only showers of the way. By you must the effort be made. So because of this, he lost sight of his own fundamental awareness. He drifted away from actually really inhabiting his experience. He was trying to inhabit a model of himself that was being created by the system he joined in a way, which I think is quite problematic. And he realized he had to get into his awareness, he had to dwell in it, he had to cultivate it, he had to make the Dharma, the Buddha's teaching, if that's what he wanted to use, his actual experience, rather than something outside of himself. So, if I'd been in that position, like Ananda, I could imagine myself, rather than the results of this longest, very interesting discussion, thinking, oh, I'm going to have to write a book about that. I could call it, you know, Finding the Mind. Yes. And that would explore all this stuff. And I wonder what the Buddha would have said if I was a young one about a book about it. But hang on, that you still haven't quite got it, have you? This is not what we're talking about. We're not talking about trying to turn it into ideas and trying to explain it to others. You've got to sit down and find your awareness. You've got to find your own mind. And then, once you've found it, you then need to expand its scope in a way this is the Buddha's project. Discover its boundaries and its limitations and see whether you can start to melt away those boundaries and limitations that you actually encounter when you look at your experience. So, yes, I feel a little bit embarrassed about adding to the world of books. But it could be useful. It could be useful. It looks at the whole Buddhist tradition, and it looks at the way that mind has been understood in Buddhism, as well as ways in which one can come to experience one's own mind more fully through Buddhist practice. And so after the story of Ananda, there's a chapter called The Garden of Impressions, which describes the Alaya, the storehouse consciousness of one of the schools of Buddhism, the substrate consciousness, which is in a way the material of awareness that manifests in what is sometimes called, in Zen, it's called the small mind. And I find this a very useful way of looking at things. In a way, this is when the Buddha said, this is not your mind. Ananda was identified fully with the small mind. And the small mind is a petty need to try to identify with just a part of our experience, one aspect of it, and feel that we own that and control it, rather fearfully protecting what we think of as ourself, as well as the views and possessions that we hold. And this process of sort of making the small mind in Buddhism is called, well, it's got three stages to it. One stage is called mind making, another stage is called eye making, and then the subtle stage of all is called the I am conceit, or the conceit I am, which we'll be going to. There's more about that in the book. And then there's a chapter called the Mirror of Awareness, which looks at the Tibetan Wheel of Life as a sort of an ability to reflect your mind. It's like a very complex symbol, but as you look into it, in a visual form, it reflects ways in which your mind can be. It's a fascinating symbol. And then there's also material and understanding states of mind, that's kind of the compassion, and the sky-like mind of meditation, and the cultivation of insight and wisdom. And there's a little section just looking at rebirth. And finally, there's a chapter called Buddha in the Laboratory, describing Western views of the mind, including some of the findings of neuroscience and how they compare with the Buddhist approach, which I find a really fascinating area and would, in a way, deserve a book of its own. So it's intended, this book, to be accessible to people that don't have any knowledge of Buddhism, but just find that approach of interest. So I hope that if you know anyone like that, do tell them about the book. It could be a good introduction. People who like something to get to their mental teeth into it, like, but yet it doesn't assume any prior knowledge. And there are also some practical exercises in the book to help you find your mind. And best of all, there are some beautiful woodcut illustrations by Murakami, which I'm really pleased of some of the little stories and anecdotes and so on in the woodcut illustrations. And what I hope that the book can do, if you do read it, is to feed a sense of curiosity about your own awareness, not to tell you the answers to the Buddha's questions, but feed a sense of curiosity until you can make that investigation that enables you to, in a way, move from small mind to big mind, vast mind, scarlet mind, and see that that crucial trustworthiness in a deep sense of one's awareness. And superficial sense is quite untrustworthy, it often misleads us, but there's something down there which is all we've got. It's just opening to our experience, the validity of each person's experience, not relying on what somebody else is telling you. In Matangi's case, she had assumed that she was untouchable. She'd accepted that fact. She'd accepted that role in life. She hadn't realised, until she met somebody who treated her differently, that she didn't have to accept that. She could actually look at herself and come to her own understanding of her experience. And then, in a different way, Ananda, even though he was the one who helped her there, he also had the same problem, but in terms of his sort of religious identity rather than a caste identity, where he just thought, yes, I'm just a follower of the Buddha, aren't I? You know, rather than saying, no, you're somebody who's got to find your own awareness and work with it. And we've already got the raw material of enlightenment. It's one of the very positive, optimistic ideas of Buddhism, is that the raw material of enlightenment is this very awareness that is active at this very moment. You don't need to add something else to it. And that's very encouraging. And we tend to make things so complicated. We proliferate so many thoughts and notions on the top of that bare awareness, if you know what I mean by that. But we don't actually have to do that. I can't remember the exact quote, but an artifact in teaching, Tsongkhapa, says, you don't need to think so much. You don't need to be so busy. Slightly challenging, isn't it? But I do. I've got to think this thing through, you know. I've got so much to do. But what, in a way, he's saying, no, you don't need to. You can let your mind be calmer. You can let your life be still as well. It is possible. Nobody is forcing you to think so much. Nobody is forcing you to be so busy. Easier said than done. So the thing is to take one's own experience seriously, to take one's awareness seriously. And what I would say is that to be present in your experience is more important than how you interpret your experience. So we're very tempted to have a lot of interpretations of what it all means and what's, you know, what is sort of more significance and less significance, and what's going to force us to act and what we're going to ignore, all that kind of stuff. But no, the important thing is to be present in your experience much more than how you interpret your experience. And sooner or later you'll notice that there are limitations to your awareness when you're present there in the experience. You start to nudge up against walls, as it were. And they may be the walls, for example, of fear. You feel very anxious about moving through into that particular area. You know, I don't know what it might be thinking about the reality of one's own death, for example. It could be reflecting on what your childhood was like. Maybe all sorts of things there. In a way, you found a boundary, you find a wall there. It may be, the wall might be the one of generating real empathy for somebody going through a lot of difficulty. You may say, I can't really go there. You know, I can't quite cope. would know the kind of pain that she's in at the moment. So we have these no-go areas, inhibitions, anxieties, also feelings of aversion and longing. And these feelings of aversion and longing keep you away from simply turning towards what's happening. One of the teachers down in the West London Buddhist Centre, which is the one I go to, his mantra, as it were, I don't know if he made this up, but he says, always turn towards your experience. And of course, this is very easy to do when you're experiencing nuts, when you're having a delicious meal, and you're watching a good film, and making art. But, he says, turn towards your experience even when it's uncomfortable. And of course, the instinctive, natural thing to do when things are uncomfortable is to turn away from experience and to avoid, you know, to actually avoid it, to find some sort of comfort or intoxication or oblivion even somewhere else. It's as if when you pull back the duvet first thing in the morning, you look at what kind of day it is, and the duvet goes back again and then you're coming. But turn towards it. That's the suggestion, I think, of Buddhist mindfulness practice. Whatever it is, if it's nice, turn towards it. Enjoy it. If it's not so nice, turn towards it, and you will learn from doing that. And there are all sorts of preconceptions and assumptions that we make. There are expectations that we've got. We want things to be a certain way. And we try to reach out into experiences that are not happening, out of experiences that are happening. We say, I don't like this one, I'm going to try and get into this other one that's not actually there at all. It's a bit of a fantasy. And we try and artificially create it and avoid what's really going on. We put so much effort into all this stuff. So, my conclusion for this is a very simple one. In a way, Buddhism has got two stages to it. The first stage is this turning away. The first stage is bringing awareness to your experience. Once you've done that, the second stage of Buddhism is to start to melt away some of the limitations and boundaries that you notice in your experience. And if you're working on those two things, in a way, that's all you need to do. And all the methods of Buddhism, like meditation and so on, are just ways of making that a bit more likely to happen, a bit more easy. Anyway, enough about that. That's a bit theoretical. Back to Ananda and Matangi. What happens next in the story? Well, in one version, the Buddha then turns to Matangi himself. And he asks her, what do you want? Because he's been talking to him, to Ananda all this time. She's been sitting there quite interested, listening. And he says, okay, I'm telling you, what do you want? But she's a very single-minded woman. She's not forgotten what it was all about. She said, I know what I want. I want to marry Ananda, don't I? and Buddha sort of thinks of Ananda and he says, well, I think I can help you. I think I can help you to join Ananda's family. And so he suggests that she herself is ordained as a Buddhist nun. And he says, well, if you did this, you would be Ananda's sister. Because we're all brothers and sisters in the order. And so you'd be Ananda's sister. Now, you couldn't be his wife in the traditional sense, because after all, he is a monk who's taking these vows. You wouldn't be sleeping together, you wouldn't be having children together, you couldn't set up a house together. So it doesn't sound so good, really, does it, in a way? But instead, you and Ananda, in your own ways, would be united in pursuing the freedom of awakening. And actually, she goes for it. She says, yeah, right. I like that idea. Yes, I can go for that. Yes. Okay, right. No, make it happen, right? And so he obeys her as a nun. Now, this causes a scandal. Because remember, Matangi was an untouchable. And the local Brahmins are very, very upset that the Buddha has ordained an untouchable woman. And so they make him kick her across. But you can't. She can't. You're supposed to be a spiritual. She's a dirty outcast. You know, she shouldn't be allowed to be involved in the spiritual. And I won't tell you some of the nasty things that the caste Hindus have done. Over the years to people, to outcasts and untouchables who have dared to try to join spiritual traditions. Not that all Hindus have actually, but many do. So the Buddha takes this opportunity to give them a lecture on the evils of untouchability and talk about the problems with untouchability and how every human being has the same potential for enlightenment, whether they're an untouchable or a Brahmin or any other caste, whether they're Indian or Chinese, whether they are male or female, whether they're young or old. Everyone has that basic potential for enlightenment because they're human beings. So I'm not going to go into that very much, but it's interesting as a source of Buddhist teachings on the evils of the caste system. Now, the story of Ananda and Matangi was actually one of the first Buddhist stories known in Europe, because it was translated by the first great scholar of Buddhism, a guy called Eugène Burnouf, in his monumental Introduction to the History of Indian Buddhism. And this was, believe it or not, published in Paris in 1844. We're going back a long way, 1844. And I think it's fair to say that he's generally regarded as the first genuine scholar of Buddhism. Buddhism was known earlier than that, but he was the first one to really try to gather data about the religion and to come to his own conclusions in his own day, a fairly sort of scientific way. Although he's often blamed for some of the ideas that we still hold about Buddhism in the West. And he is, and because he was had such a weighted scholarship, the conclusions he came to, some of which were mistaken, are still echoing around there. I won't go into details there, but to some extent, for example, the late Victorian, as we were saying, scholars of Buddhism saw Buddhism as being rather a detached, scientific, rationalistic approach to things, and they sort of ignored the much more colourful stories and myths and legends and images and so on. And that sort of has echoed down to this. So you even got the extent when Tibetan Buddhism became better and better known, some of the early scholars there simply dismissed the whole thing as being mere superstition. And they missed the riches that are there in Tibetan Buddhism as a result for some time. Nevertheless, he was a great man, and he wrote this book. It was fairly widely read. In fact, it was Schopenhauer who recommended it to Richard Wagner. So Wagner, the composer, in 1856, 1858, around that time, he read the book, he got very interested in Buddhism, and he decided to write an opera about the story of Ananda and Matangi. And he was so struck by this story, he thought, this would make a fantastic Wagnerian opera. And he wrote a sketch of this opera, and he was going to call it Die Sieger, The Victors, based on the story. He even picked up, I'm not sure whether Bernou says this, but he even picked up that Matangi was the first woman to be ordained by the Buddha. So in a way there was a double scandal connected with her ordination. The Brahmins were a very patriarchal group, and they were very upset, not just that she was untouchable, but she was also a woman. So there was this double scandal and double revolutionary acts by the Buddha, which Wagner was very interested in. So the story brings out many reflections on the inhumane treatment of one group of people by another. But the main thing that he wanted to bring out was not so much the issue of the untouchable maiden, but the issue of her decision to shift her aspiration from a settled, loving, domestic life with Ananda happily ever after to her own liberation. And the liberation of others, a compassionate engagement with the liberation of others, which is what the Buddha taught her. And Wagner felt that this was a heroic act by her. He was very interested in self-sacrifice, as you probably know, sometimes quite literally. But in her case, it was a particular kind of sacrifice that he felt was admirable, as he saw it, where she was choosing this path to liberation over domestic life. And so she's one of the victors in story. And strangely enough, another one of the victors in the story, goodness, look at the time, is the Buddha. Because according to Wagner's interpretation, the Buddha himself learnt from this process, learnt from the Tanya and her responses, and learnt from his interaction with both Ananda and the Tanya. And of course, the other victor was Wagner. And Wagner wrote a sketch of this opera. but he never finished the work, and gradually is involved into his masterwork, Parsifal. And that's really what he wrote. But the echoes of the story are still there, and the character of Kundry in Parsifal is based on Matungi. I think some people have even commented that she drifts quite a long way from Kundry, an ancient German legend, into this much more rich figure. And I don't know how much time, I'll just mention this briefly, but the great Bengali poet Rabindranath Tagore was also very interested by the story. He wrote a play based on it in 1938 called Chandalika. And Chandalika means the outcast maiden. Again, I've not seen it, unfortunately. It's very interesting. The only characters in it are Ananda, Matangi, and Matangi's mother. So it's quite an intense play of the relationship between these people. Again, exploring the issue of untouchability and so on. I think it is an interesting area. I'm not surprised that Roman picked up on it. The whole area, in a way of, is there actually a competition between one's spiritual aspirations and one's romantic or sexual aspirations? You have the tradition in Buddhism of a celibate, chaste group of monks, but it was always clear that you didn't have to be a monk or a nun to practice Buddhism. You could practice Buddhism from a family life. But yet the Buddha did seem to be very encouraging. If somebody was free to do so, he said, don't get involved in romantic entanglements if you've got an aspiration to pursue meditation and the Dharma. But I mean, for me and many other Western Buddhists I know, we try to have the best of both worlds. You know, I have a partner in a very loving relationship. I really enjoy it. I really appreciate it. I appreciate particularly that possibility of very close intimacy which you can have with one person you gradually get to know more and more, you know. So I don't fancy really making that decision. Maybe I don't need to. Maybe circumstances are different, you know. In a way, we have more freedom now to choose a much wider range of lifestyles. So I'm very pleased in that sense to belong to an order that doesn't insist on celibacy for its members. It says that it's the commitment that is primary, and on the basis of that commitment, you then choose what your lifestyle is going to be. You try and express your commitment as best you can through that lifestyle. Now, what about Matangi herself? Well, this decision for her to become ordained, as well as her teachings by the Buddha, was a real turning point for her, it seems, and she gained enlightenment. In fact, she overtakes Ananda. She gets up on the fast lane and becomes enlightened quite quickly. So we have this enlightened woman, and poor old Ananda, he's still struggling, he's still not quite got it. And it's not being stupid, I think we should be sympathetic towards him. I mean, in a way, he's much more like us, you know, obviously she had some very deep spiritual turmoil. And he was still puzzled, he was still a bit lost, he was still a long way from enlightenment. And so, the Buddha said, okay, what can we do for Ananda now? I know what I'll do. He went around, he asked all the great meditation teachers, the great meditators present, to come up with something for Ananda, to really give him the edge. And he said, okay, look, what would you suggest? What kind of meditation would you do? What kind of meditation did you do? What would it up to? So one by one, they describe, and again, in this long sutra, you'll find these very fascinating descriptions of all sorts of meditation methods, described in some detail. So if you like playing around with meditation, there's a lot of material in there. And eventually, the last one to describe his method was Avalokiteshvara, known in China, which is where the sutra is preserved, as Kuan Yin. And normally in China, in a female form, female bodhisattva of compassion. And this is part of what she says. I once met a Buddha who taught me to enter deep meditation through a process of hearing and reflecting. Initially, I entered the flow through hearing, and I forgot objective states. Since the sense objects and sense organs were quiet, the two characteristics of movement and stillness were crystallized and did not arise. And after that, gradually advancing, the hearing and what was heard both disappeared. The hearing and what was heard both disappeared. Once the hearing was ended, there was nothing to rely on. And awareness and the objects of awareness became empty. And when the emptiness of awareness reached an ultimate perfection, emptiness and what was being emptied then also ceased to be. And since production and extinction were both gone, still extinction was revealed, still extinction. And suddenly, I transcended the mundane and the transcendental worlds, and throughout the 10 directions, a perfect brightness prevailed, and I obtained 2 supreme states. First, I was united above with the fundamental, wonderfully enlightened mind of all the Buddhas, and I gained the strength of compassion equal to that of all the Buddhas. Second, I was united below with all living beings in 6 realms, and I gained a kind regard for all living beings equally. So now, I don't contemplate sounds for their own sake, but rather I listen to the sounds of those people whom I contemplate, and I can enable living beings throughout the 10 directions who are suffering or in distress to attain liberation by contemplating their sounds. And I think that Guanyin means the cry regarder, the one who listens to the cries of beings. And so she's regarded as this enormously attentive being. So that's why she's there in Buddhist mythology, as somebody who you feel is always there for you, always listening to you. That's the way she expresses her compassion. And I think this suggestion that she has, listening to yourself, in all senses of that word listen, is the best way to be open in solidarity to the common experience that we all have. So you're listening to yourself, but you're also listening to what we have in common with other people, listening to others. So in the sutra, the Buddha asked Manjushri, Bodhisattva of Wisdom, to adjudicate. So we've got a bit of an X factor going on here. Line them all up. Who's going to win? Who is going to win the best meditation? But I'm going to have to go away. And I'll go to the program next week. We'll say, how did you get on? You try the one that you're recommended. And Manjushri chooses Apakdasha's method, turning the organ of hearing inwards. And he said this would be best for Ananda. And he said, Ananda, you in the past, you've been concentrating on learning to uphold the Buddha's teachings. Why don't you listen to your own hearing? And in his own way, Ananda was a great listener, as you know, but he wasn't really listening to himself. He'd taken in everything the Buddha had said. But then he heard Matangi whispering in his ear, and he was led by that away from his awareness. He lost his awareness. He needed to listen to his own hearing, as Manjushri puts it. He needed to open his awareness to what was simply there. Not even trying to decide whether it was inside or outside, whether it was a sense or an object of sense, whether it was empty or full, all those dualities of this kind of meditation. And I won't come into that, unfortunately, but if you think of what hearing is like, hearing transcends dualities. Is this sound inside you or outside you? You could probably argue for both of those positions, couldn't you? Anyway, Ananda went off. He attempted this type of mindfulness meditation, it's his main meditation method. But it wasn't a short path. And in fact, it wasn't until the Buddha died, sometime later, that Ananda made his breakthrough. And because the Buddha was dead, all the great disciples got together to come to an agreement about what Buddhism was. Because all very well the Buddha's alive, you don't have to worry about it, you know. But when the Buddha's dead, they said, okay, he's dead. What is it that we're doing? What is Buddhism? And so they all said, I know what it is, you know. So they all had to sit down and rehearse all the teachings they heard from the Buddha. But they realised very quickly, well, Ananda is the one with the best memory. He can remember most of it. We should invite him along. And then somebody said, no, hang on a minute, we've got a rule. For the council, you've got to be enlightened to attend. Ananda is not enlightened. He can't attend. So they sat there twiddling their thumbs, and they sent Mahakashyapa along to see Ananda. And Mahakashyapa went on to see Ananda. He said, look, Ananda, we need you at the council. I said, okay, I'll come along. They said, yeah, but there's a rule. You've got to be enlightened. And Ananda said, oh, all right then. All right, I'll try. So he sat down, held his hands in his lap, and he tried this meditation of inner hearing. He tried, and he tried, and he tried. And in the end, he gave up. And he said, I can't do it. I'm off to bed. And according to the story, as he leapt into his bed, while he was still in mid-air, before his body touched the mattress, his mind was completely liberated. And so thereafter, he was able to recite his teachings at the First Council, and that's how we got Buddhism. It all starts, all the early sutras starts, or Ashram, starts, thus have I heard. And that is Ananda saying, this is what I memorised. So I'm going to leave it there. Little time for questions. Very short time, I think, for questions. But also, I'll be outside if anyone wants a book and you can ask some questions more personally. Does anybody want to ask anything about that? Little summary of finding the mind in Buddhism. Yes? While he was in midair. Any ideas? I've never tried that particular style of meditation. And the trouble is, it's very brief. But if you were on the moon, say, or if you were in outer space, it might be a very, very good way of meditating. You know, just to sort of find yourself sort of slowly circling through space, you know, you have a bit more chance to do it. Any other questions? Yes.
A standard sign of the tradition to be an incongruity between Matinga's feeling that she was being treated as a person.
Yes.
Which seemed to be an affirmation of self. And at the same time, Ananda's needing to learn to, in a sense, lose himself.
I'm really glad you brought that up. I think that's really interesting, because it's as if what Matangi needed was self-confidence, wasn't it? That's what she was lacking. I'm reading it into the story, actually, but I think that's what she was lacking. So, in a way, being treated suddenly so well as a human being, being taken seriously, was really what she needed, really made all the difference. And I think that really, if you start from a position of lack of confidence, of even not liking yourself and so on, then to go into teachings of the not really being a persistent, abiding core of suffering, which is what Buddhism teaches, it's just premature. It's not really going to help you. In fact, you'll probably take it the wrong way. So it's as if Ananda didn't have problems of confidence, he had problems of mindfulness, of awareness. He wasn't actually prepared to take in what was really going on for him. And that's what he needed to deal with. And presumably, Matangi, at least, you know, if you accept the tradition, she must have seen through the sense of a solid self in order to gain enlightenment, because that's what Buddhism said she would have to do. Mm-hmm. So she went through this stage of self-confidence, and from that basis of self-confidence, she realised, it's alright, this is fine. In a way, I am, you know, a flowing process. I'm not a thing. I'm not, I mean, in a way, it's the same, I'm not an untouchable, but I'm not even me, in a sort of profound sense. I'm not saying I fully understand that, but I think it's a very interesting question, and I think it is, in a way, an important distinction to make. And so to come to that non-self teaching in a vacuum, I think it's probably would easily be, very easily be misunderstood. But the same goes to teaching about emptiness, where people think nothing is important, nothing matters, you know, it's all just, it wouldn't make any difference what we do. And that's not what emptiness is about. Anyway, it's a good question. Thank you. The last one before we... Okay, well, thank you very much for coming. And I'm going to go out now and see you there. I think is there a time for a cup of tea or anything before? There is time for a cup of tea, so you can have a tea, possibly even a biscuit.